I'm Peter Solomon. You're listening to Jazz 88. On June 10th, the Heights Theater will screen a restored and remastered version of the film Artie Shaw, Time is All You've Got, a Canadian documentary that earned both an Oscar and Academy Award in 1987. Filmmaker Bridget Berman will be in attendance for a Q&A session at that June 10th screening. Berman actually made two acclaimed jazz documentaries in the 1980s. The first film, called Ain't None of Them Played Like Him Yet, told the story of Big Spiderbeck. Today happens to be Artie Shaw's birthday. I invited Bridget Berman to come on the program with me to discuss her documentary about the great clarinet player. Welcome, Bridget, and I guess to begin with, could you tell me how your interest in Artie Shaw as a subject for a documentary came about?
Great. Yes, indeed. So I made a film about Big Spiderbeck. You mentioned two films. And for that film, I interviewed Artie Shaw because Artie Shaw had roomed with Big Spiderbeck in the later years. And also I knew Artie Shaw was a big name, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could get Artie Shaw into the Big Spiderbeck documentary? So he agreed. I went down to LA. I did the interview, and it was an amazing interview. He's such an incredible talker, as you can tell. It tells stories, you know, and I ended up shooting much more than I had planned. And when I was editing the Bix film, finishing it, you know, and I looked at Artie Shaw's interview, I thought, wow, you know, he is very interesting. This could make another very amazing documentary. I decided, yes, I would like to make that the next one I'm going to do. But I knew that, first of all, he would have to see my work because he's very critical and he doesn't give anybody permission easily. He's never allowed anyone before to do a story about his life on film. And so, sure enough, he came to see the Bix film when it was at the LA Film Festival and took me out for dinner afterwards, and we talked about the Bix film, and then he said, what are you going to do next? And I said, I'd love to do a film about you, Mr. Shaw. And he said, oh, and he said, why? He wanted to know the reason. Well, I was ready because I knew he would ask me that. And so I said, Big Spiderbeck, a young man, you know, as the title of the film, Young Man with a Horn. Absolutely, he died at a very early age, age 28 in 1931. And he was an artist who gave everything completely and never knew how to say no, never said no. People would carry him off to speakeasies. He would go, they'd plow him with drink. He'd drink the bad booze, everything, and out and up all night. And so he was the artist who died very young. But Artie Shaw, you are the artist who is a survivor. If you don't like something, you say no. If something goes wrong, seriously, like when he got ill and realized, you know, he didn't want to continue with the morons, he called the jitterbuggers morons, you know, so he quit. He would quit again and again and again, and he survived. Now, in an essence for myself, I don't think either one is good in itself. There needs to be a balance, but Bix, you know, the young artist who did not survive, Artie Shaw, the survivor, and he loved it. You know, he thought that was really great. And he said, sure, you know, go ahead. And when do you want to start? And I said, tomorrow. So literally, I started the next day. And that's how I made the film, which took 3.5 years to make.
Yeah, so there's a few things I want to follow up on with Artie Shaw there. So I feel like there's two facets at work when you look at Shaw's career. There's the desire for commercial success, with which, without a doubt, he achieved. He was at the very top of the field of swing music. And then there's the other side of him that always seems to manifest, and that's his artistic vision and his need to be true to his art and not to, I guess, sell out as he might have looked at it. Can you talk about the dichotomy of those two things and how that kind of impacts Artie Shaw and his career?
Well, you know, as you say, he, and as several of the people in the film say, he was an absolute perfectionist. He taught himself how to play that clarinet. I mean, at 180, 90, 200%, he knew it. He knew it inside out. He knew how to put a band together, how to shape a band. And he was, you know, he wanted the best band, the best orchestra. There was a constant back and forth between him and Benny Goodman, who was the better clarinetist, who had the better band, and which is kind of silly. They were both really, really, really good. But it gets funny in the film. He talks about that. So he was this incredible perfectionist and loved to play the music, absolutely. And when you watch him play, listen to the blues, in his mind, and he kind of revisits his own playing because he stopped playing quite a few years later, you can see how the music lives inside of him, in his very heart and soul. He's completely 100% a musician, a genius. But at the same time, of course, because he got so popular and he wanted that fame, he was happy for that fame and he liked the money, no question. But with it came, of course, what he did not like, which was the jitterbuggers who, you know, kind of went crazy dancing and screaming. You know, you couldn't hear his music sometimes, I'm sure. And he hated that. He absolutely hated those trappings of success. And he wanted to be pure in his music. And he wanted people to listen, to listen, to listen. But, you know, you can't control people. And as Mel Torme says, he might have hated the jitterbuggers, but it was the jitterbuggers that made him, because they went to his performances. They were crazy about him, absolutely. Young and old, you know, he was huge. But he would hate what he had created. It was like an Achilles heel. And so he would walk away from the band, but then he couldn't let go. He would come back, he would have to pay taxes. He would get a band to make money to pay the taxes. He was really caught as an artist and as a commercial musician, not a commercial musician, but as a musician that was adored and was out there, and the people went crazy over him. He hated that part, absolutely hated it. And so it was all his life that followed him. There were other musicians who hated that as well, but Artie Shaw was so outspoken that he, you know, he kind of said it as it was. He called them morons. And of course, the papers publicized that, big, huge letters, morons. And of course, people didn't like that. So there was a love-hate relationship, back and forth.
Now, kind of switching gears, Artie Shaw had one thing in common with Benny Goodman and Charlie Barnett, and I guess you could probably name a few others, Tommy Dorsey, who worked with black musicians at a time when, you know, the bands weren't really integrated. So, you know, you dealt with the example of Billie Holiday in your film, and he also had Orrin Hotlips Page, and there was a really interesting story about how he was set to go on a tour through the South with Page. And then I know that there was more stories about Roy Eldridge that you didn't probably have time to address. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about his relationship to some of these black musicians that he chose to include in his band.
Any old time you want me, I am yours for just the asking, darling. Any old time you need me, I'll be there with love that's lasting, darling.
Well, you know, in fact, he was the very first band leader to hire a black person and tour the South. He hired Billie Holiday. He liked her singing enormously. And to him, you know, black, white, no difference. You know, to him, it's the musician and the singer and the quality of their talent. And he hired her and he toured the South. And of course, it was not something that was the South was ready to accept. And there would be incidents when, you know, Billie ended up calling the heckler, who called her names. She called him back names. She had a temper as Artie. And she was right too. I mean, how dare he? So an artichoke quickly, you know, hustled her off the stage and away so it wouldn't end up in a riot. It was pretty serious. And of course, again, Hot Lips Page, he hired him later, an incredible trumpeter, and he was the heart of that band, and was amazing. And like you say, again, Artichoke committed himself to a Southern tour when the agent found out that there was a black trumpet player in the band. He said, okay, you can travel down to the South with Hot Lips Page, but Hot Lips Page has to sit 15 feet away from the rest of the band when he plays his trumpet throughout the entire performance. And when Artie heard that, he thought, this is crazy. I mean, you know, forget it. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to have Hot Lips Page sitting way out there by himself. And he canceled the tour.
I'm Peter Solomon. You're listening to a conversation with filmmaker Bridget Berman, whose documentary Artichoke, Time Is All You've Got, earned both an Academy Award and an Oscar. It's being screened at the Heights Theater on June 10th. After your film won an Oscar, Artichoke filed suit because he wanted a share of the profits from the film, and I was wondering if that colored your perspective of him after that point. It was thrown out of court, right?
Yeah. What happened was that the film won an Oscar, and about 3 weeks later, I get a phone call from Artichoke, and I had, you know, he had a small percentage in the film, but I had raised all the money. I had paid everybody, you know, instead of buying a house, I made the film. It came all out of my own finances and my paycheck every week, because I worked my regular job at the CBC, evenings and weekends and holidays, I made the Artichoke film. So the money just went back and forth. Anyway, so I get the call and Artie says, you know, Bridget, now that the film's won the Oscar, it is a commodity and I want a big share of that profit. And I said, Artie, what are you talking about? That was not our arrangement. Well, that is what I want. Of course, when Artie wants something, he expects to get it. That's happened all his life whenever he wanted something. I said no. It was difficult and I was scared because, you know, I knew he could be vindictive. Thank God I had a really good lawyer who felt this was totally wrong and said to me, I will stand by you. Whatever happens, I'll be there. I'm not going to charge you for this. I'm going to do it pro bono. What he is doing is wrong. And the other thing is that he wanted a controlling share. And I knew it was even more about the film. He wanted to control me. He wanted to control the film. And in essence, he loved the film so much that he wanted to make it his. And I wasn't going to allow that. Mm-hmm. And so it went to court, and Canadian court, a week of trial. It was really expensive. It was horrible. And then waiting for the verdict, and we won, thank God, thank God. And then he took it to the Supreme Court of Ontario, and the three judges all threw it out within minutes, you know, and he lost there. And then a year later, I think, he sued me from California. And so I had to go and defend myself in California, which was really, really expensive. And it was horrible. It killed my creativity. I felt so betrayed. How could he turn around after I make this film that honors him and honors his music? How could he do that? And a documentary in those days, and even now, you don't make a lot of money with documentaries. So I know it was not about the money. It was about control. And I was not going to give him control.
Right. Well, he would have never done that as an artist. It's kind of the ironic thing. If someone had come to him and tried to control his art, like, there's no way he would have allowed that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, he wanted me to take out I narrate the film. He hated the narration. Suddenly, you know, a year after the film was made, I hadn't yet submitted it to the Academy Awards. He decided, I don't like your narration, Bridget. You're going to have to take it out. Well, you know how much money that would have cost to do that? No, I said, I'm not doing it. And then when the film got nominated, he stopped about that. But he always he came up with things, you know, I don't like this, I don't like that. And every person who wanted photographs of Artie Shaw, he would send them to me. I became his unpaid PR person. It was crazy.
Wow. But yet you still seem to look very generously upon him. And it seems like you've been able to move past that experience.
You know, it took a long time. It took a very, very long time. I could not look at the film. My late husband, who was a producer, Victor Solnicki, loved the film and he would watch it. You know, I would never join him. I could not look at it. I could not listen to the music. I didn't speak ill of him because I don't believe in doing that. For the longest time, I could not make films again. Not until Victor, who is also a producer, we ended up making 3 documentaries together. But it killed me. And then I won, finally, in California. And a year later, he died. Mm. And it was over. I could breathe again. And that's really when I began to make documentaries again. And it was interesting because when he died, the CBC called me to do an interview with me. I didn't get the message that same day, but my girlfriend called me and said, guess what? We just heard he's passed away. And I was like, oh my God, I was thrilled. You know, and I mean, I was really, you know, like what an awful man, you know, da 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 da. I was, oh. And then overnight, it settled in on me and I was thinking about it and I thought, you know, what a essentially sad person, because yes, he achieved fame, but at what a cost. I mean, his son who was interviewed after Artie Shaw died said, my father died the way he lived, miserable and alone. Oh. Now, would you want your child to say that after you die? I don't think so. You know, but what happened? So I did the interview the following day and I had kind of put everything in perspective. So I did an interview. I talked about his music. I talked about who he was musically and the heritage that he left behind. And, you know, and of course that he was a very difficult person. Yes, I put that in. But I was much more magnanimous about him because ultimately he was his own worst enemy. And I began to realize that. And there was no point in me continuing to hold this anger, which was only hurting me inside of me. So I still could not watch the film. And it wasn't until I decided that I had to restore this film because it has to be available for people who kept asking to see it. And, you know, so I knew I had to restore it after I restored Bix. So I didn't really want to. My heart, I was kind of afraid. But once I started to look at it, I kind of really liked the work that this younger me had done. I was very proud of it. And slowly I began to re-own the film. And now I'm very proud of it. Now I can talk about him. I can talk, you know, about the film. I can watch the film. It has healed, you know, but it took a long time.
I've been speaking with documentary maker Bridget Berman. Her film, Artie Shaw, Time is All You've Got, is coming to the Heights Theater on June 10th. Berman will be in attendance for a Q&A session. I'm Peter Solomon for Jazz 88.